It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin voters decide on a proposed constitutional amendment in the spring election. That's now 3 weeks away, making it more difficult for people accused of violent crimes to get out on bail, and expanding what judges must consider when setting bail, like the defendant's criminal record. Call in with your questions, your comments about cash bail, and how you think this amendment would affect justice. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marianne Olson is executive assistant to the directors of EXPO, or Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. It's a group that seeks to end mass incarceration and restore formerly incarcerated people to full participation in society. Marianne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So your group, EXPO, unsuccessfully sued to try to keep the bail referendum off the ballot in April. What is your objection to it?
Our objection is we honestly did not have enough time to educate Wisconsinites what this amendment will actually mean. And because of that, we were hoping to have more time to help explain what's in this, what's not in this, and the potential impact on our communities.
Well, here is some time to explain. Here's some space. What is the impact on our communities?
Well, thank you so much. We do appreciate this. Right now, under the bill, serious harm is defined as any of the following: personal physical pain or injury, illness, any impairment of physical condition or death, including mental anguish or emotional harm, damage to property over $2,500 in value, or economic loss over $2,500 in value. LRB 1475 defines violent crimes by listing well over 100 statutes. That actually...
Is that a lot?
Well, it is. And the statutes that are involved, you wouldn't consider violent crimes. Jeopardizing profits, observing cockfights, access to abortion care. There are so many statutes that the impact we recognize on almost 185,000 Wisconsinites that have been convicted of a felony in just the last 40 years.
But why?
We were looking for more time.
Why shouldn't a judge consider the whole person, their whole history, when deciding how dangerous someone is or how much of a flight risk?
That we agree with. Where we have a problem is right now Wisconsin's reliance on cash bail would continue and actually would be perpetuated. And a cash bail system has impact, and it causes further inequality. We cannot really talk about cash bail in Wisconsin without acknowledging how it's impacted our communities already in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has for the second time been recognized as imprisoning Black people at far higher rates than the population.
Can you explain, I want to just jump in. Can you explain, like, and really connect us to how bail can affect someone's life who is accused of a crime?
Well, okay. We can talk about the Prison Policy Initiative has shared in research that just 3 days being detained can impact a person's employment, financing, housing, their family. It can have a significant impact on the well-being of dependent children. We know that that will impact communities. What we'd rather see is answers that will keep communities safe. Preventative care would keep communities safe. We simply do not believe that jails, pretrial detention disappears problems, it disappears people.
I'm going to just reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk about a proposed amendment to the state constitution that will be on the ballot next month. Marianne Olson is with us, an activist with ex-incarcerated people organizing. You can join in the conversation. Your questions and comments about bail, 800-642-1234. Marianne, I want to switch the focus here of the conversation and look deeply at your personal life. You were charged with several felonies for selling fake stock more than a decade ago. What bail was imposed in your case, and how did it affect your life?
This is true. And the lowest my bail ever got was $50,000. I was never able to make my bail. And eventually had a nervous breakdown and stopped fighting. And research shows what happened to me is what's most common. People that are held pretrial detention most often end up receiving longer sentences, even go on to commit further crimes.
When should a person be required to stay in jail ahead of a trial? Is there a time and a place for that?
Yes, we do believe that a no cash system similar to what they're using in New Jersey that actually use risk assessment. Now, I don't want to say relying solely on compass tools because they do perpetuate inequalities. A no cash bail doesn't rely on a person's wealth to buy their freedom. It actually will look at keeping communities safe.
New Jersey now, as you mentioned, the state is also required to provide each defendant a hearing within 48 hours to determine if they will be released. What do you think the effect of that is, and how does that compare to Wisconsin?
The New Jersey system has already been shown to be the most comprehensive and successful. Recidivism has reduced and the incarceration rate has been cut almost in half. By using risk as the sole factor for pretrial incarceration, it changes. It doesn't matter if a person is wealthy or not. Release on recognizance should actually be the default pretrial outcome.
Marianne Olson is with the group Expo, or Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, advocating against mass imprisonment. Call in with your questions, your comments about amending the state constitution in such a way that it would make it harder for people accused of violent crimes to get out of jail on bail. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead of the April 4th election, we hear perspective on a ballot question that would allow judges to consider more factors when setting bail for offenders, amending our state constitution. Call in with your questions, your thoughts about this bail amendment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marianne Olson is assistant to the directors of Expo. That's a group fighting mass incarceration, working with people who have spent time behind bars. And Marianne stays with us. Let's talk about bail jumping. There was this 2016 analysis by the Wisconsin Law Review that found that bail jumping is our state's most charged crime. And without cash bail, would more people stop showing up in court?
Well, thank you for bringing up that. We actually believed wraparound services could address the root causes, would address the root causes. We know that the reasons most folks miss their court appointments is not because they are intentionally avoiding it, but because life circumstances have made it very difficult to appear in court. EXPL would utilize peer support specialists. We would provide bail advocates, things that would include text messaging services for anyone expected to remind them, hey, your court date's coming up. It's such and such a time. We would provide transportation and childcare assistance, actual real help.
Kind of
Data analysis
like
and revision to make.
I'm trying to think, when you say bail advocates, almost like health navigators, perhaps. Is there a similarity? Do you see?
Exactly. EXPL utilizes, we are peer support specialists. We know that we are the experts. Those closest to the problems are closest to the solutions. We've walked this road. We understand it. And because of that, we have trust with those who need to get this done. We can be there.
What effects do you see Wisconsin's bail system as it stands having on whether the accused person goes on to commit other crimes? What is the impact on recidivism, or can you make connections there?
Absolutely. There's been many studies that have shown pretrial detention just adds to the disparities that have already shown to cause some criminality, poverty, life strain. Pretrial detention, any length of detention, as I said, impacts families, it impacts employment, it impacts housing, and it impacts children. We know that pretrial detention most often impacts women. Are you aware in Wisconsin, in the last 40 years, we've increased the incarceration rate of women 897%? And
Wow.
I promise you, our mothers and daughters and sisters haven't been out committing crime at an increased rate of 900%. There are just better ways. We'd like to see the root problems addressed. In Wisconsin, for every $1 we invest in treatment and alternatives and diversions to incarceration, taxpayers save $8.68. That's real money. We have solutions. We are the experts, and we would like to share some of these ideas. Again, thank you for this opportunity.
I'm wondering, as you say, you've walked this journey. You have gone through the justice system. Do you feel that you are repaired? And I'm not sure the exact word to use, but do you feel that the system reformed you, or did you change yourself?
That is a difficult question. Wisconsin has a very punitive underlying culture. And I can honestly share that it has been my work with Expo and recognizing that I am more than the worst choices I made. That has been the biggest catalyst to me becoming a better neighbor, a better friend. Having barriers put in front of me constantly, including not being able to vote. I cannot vote until 2042 because of my extended supervision sentence. Not having that voice in the community, it hurts. Having a voice in the community shows me I matter. If I can be looked at as someone of value and with humanity, I then can turn around and see that in everyone around me. That makes the difference.
I think about your words that you say there. I am more than the choices I made. What
We
does
all are, right?
what do you then make of second chances as part of the criminal justice system?
Second chances are what restore people. Second chances are what restore communities. Second chances are needed. Most often, we come from not being recognized. Most often, we come from trauma. A second chance can mean life. It can mean the difference between thriving or just basically surviving and getting through.
What do you fear will happen if this constitutional amendment passes?
I feel that the incarceration rates will increase. And people will continue to be treated less than we would treat animals. When there are better practices that work to answer what happened to you instead of what did you do, can change everything. Restorative justice is what keeps communities safe. Well, communities are safe communities.
I'm going to reintroduce you, Marianne Olson, activist with ex-incarcerated people organizing, as we talk about the proposed amendment to the state constitution on the April 4th ballot. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marianne, as you're well aware, this bail amendment has been years in the making. It won approval in the last legislative session, passed this year with bipartisan support. How has your organization been working in the background on this issue over time?
By going out and sharing our truth, by sharing, as I shared with you, we are all more than the choices we regret. And hopefully, by helping people see and recognize the money again, for every dollar we invest in treatment alternatives and diversions to incarceration, we save $8.68. Putting people in prison and in jail does not disappear problem. It just disappears people.
Our state is sitting on a historic surplus, over $7 billion surplus. What would you say would be the best use of those funds in areas like criminal justice? What would you tell the legislature and the governor here?
Let's look at practices that work. Locking people up doesn't work. Answering the underlying problems that caused the criminality in the first place. Answering the needs of communities. That's what will keep us all safe.
I'm wondering, do you have a formal bail advocate program? Is that something you would pursue with grant funding? I'm just curious.
We will be working very closely to provide pretrial advocates with the wraparound services I have discussed. Because again, like I said, we know people don't avoid going to court because they just don't want to go. Life circumstances get in the way. Peer support specialists can help answer those problems.
If you could leave us with one thought about how you would envision our criminal justice system to work here in Wisconsin, what would it look like? What would it be?
We have to begin by reducing the prison population. We have to start there. And we have to recognize that we can do better, that we can work together, that Wisconsin is an outlier, not only in the impact on our Black and Brown communities, but the impact on women and the impact that that's having on children. We can do better.
Mary Ann, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Mary Ann Olson is Executive Assistant to the Directors of EXPO, or Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, and this group seeks to end mass incarceration and restore formerly incarcerated people to full participation in the life of our communities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's Maureen McCollum with an ode to a car.
Some people get really passionate about taking sides on everyday things that make our lives a little sweeter. Coke versus Pepsi, the Beatles versus the Stones, Biggie versus Tupac, and of course, manual versus automatic transmission. Writer Nancy Jorgensen is Team Manual and tells us about her love of and nostalgia for driving stick shift.
A few months before our wedding, my boyfriend bought me a car I couldn't drive. A cherry red, two-door Volkswagen Beetle. Like a little sugar bun, round and sweet. I settled in the bucket seat, hesitant after my single parking lot lesson on manual transmissions. I checked the mirrors, jerked into traffic. Don't be afraid on the hill. I shifted, gave it gas. Sedans and station wagons zipped past. The engine putt-putt sputtered, quit. A rookie with four on the floor, I didn't realize the car was in third gear. I fumbled with the clutch and stick, and after several attempts found first gear and slipped back on the road. As the four-cylinder, 60-horsepower engine purred in the rear, I relaxed a bit and let the wind tangle my hair. By the time I pulled into our alley garage, imaginary stars twinkled my Beetle, with its pedal for my left foot and its knob for my right hand. Already, I craved more practice with step-ball-change choreography. Soon, the clutch and I were like lovers. We went everywhere together. My parents' house to swim in the pool, my grandma's cottage to gather beans and eggs, my daughter's daycare center so I could teach choir classes at work. In summer, with the windows cranked, driving delivered whiffs of freshly cut grass. In winter, with a hole in the floorboard, commuting coughed up ice and sleet. That car wedded me to the road, so close were the steering wheel and windshield, so tight the space between me and Wisconsin's wavering weather. Eventually, I traded my 72 Bug for a family car with four doors. But every vehicle since, 87, 97, 09, required my left foot dance with a clutch. Five years ago, when a surgeon damaged my boyfriend, now husband's, left leg, we surrendered our manual transmission. The dealer almost refused our trade-in. "No one wants a stick shift anymore," he said. "Won't be able to sell it." Is it possible to pine for a pedal? To love a rubber-covered hunk of metal? To feel an absent clutch like a phantom limb? I sense its presence. I anticipate using it. My leg twitches and hovers in its void. But the clutch isn't all I've lost. I'll never again have parents with a backyard pool. No more grandma with gardens and chickens. No more baby daughters strapped in the back seat. Nostalgia is like a 1970s poncho. It covers me in discordant threads, some delicate, light, and brief, some weighty, rough, and lasting. Strands of memory intertwine, and it's impossible to separate one from the others. Last week, a snappy little convertible with a lion's roar zoomed past me in the park, and I felt something like longing. I imagined myself in a leather seat, downshifting on a hill, gliding through gears, third, fourth, fifth, cruising Lake Michigan's shore, sailboats on the horizon, leaning into curves at 50 miles an hour. In real life, I get behind the wheel of my SUV. A screen tells me where to go. An air conditioner cools to a precise number, and a cabin cradles me far above the bumpy pavement. But it's hard to navigate when the parts I love the most are no longer there.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer who lives in Waukesha. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Wheelchair Basketball Championships, they get underway tomorrow at UW-Whitewater. 11 universities participating in the men's intercollegiate tourney, including UW-Whitewater, whose wheelchair athletics program was founded 50 years ago. Colin, with questions about playing wheelchair basketball, the intensity, the athleticism of the sport, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeremy Meyer is on the UW-Whitewater wheelchair basketball team. Jeremy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, how are you guys doing this morning?
Doing well. Jake Williams here as well, first year as head coach of the men's program. Jake, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Hey, glad to be here.
Well, Jake, let's start with you. UW-Whitewater having national tournament titles to its name. How are you feeling about your prospects in this year's tournament?
We have a lot of talent on our team, and so I'm honestly feeling pretty good about our situation going in. I think we got a lot of favorable matchups, so I'm feeling really good about our chances to win it.
Jeremy, what are your goals for the tournament? How are you feeling?
I'm very optimistic. Ultimately, the goal is to be cutting the nets down at the end of the weekend. But as Coach just said, we have quite a bit of talent on our team and a lot of favorable matchups that should go our way as long as we kind of stick to our game plan and play as a team.
Jake, give us a little bit of your backstory and the experience you bring to the team as head coach. Can you talk about that?
I started playing wheelchair basketball in, I think, 2008 played in college for 5 years. I went to Whitewater. And then after college, I went overseas to play professional wheelchair basketball, and I've been over there for the last 7-8 years. And during that time, I've also been on Team USA for the last nine years as well. So we ended up winning 2 gold medals in Rio in 2016 and in Tokyo in 2021. So I bring a lot of experience from the international game and the way that is played. It's very fast. It's very fast paced, and you have to make a lot of quick decisions. And a lot of the onus is really on the players to make plays. And that's kind of the way I want, and I have been coaching the team.
I wonder, I've always wondered, how does dribbling work in the sport? Because there's the wheelchair and there's the basketball. How do you make sure those two are kind of in sync?
Yeah, like anything, I think it takes a lot of practice. So the dribbling rule is you can dribble one, or you have to dribble one time for every two times that you touch your wheels. So I can take 2 pushes and then dribble once. And if I take 3 pushes, it's traveling. So it's kind of like 2 steps, 3 steps in a B ball. So like anything, it takes practice, but it was definitely a different experience when I first started playing. I think the ball was going off my wheelchair a lot. But you get better for sure.
Jeremy, do you remember that effort to get the timing right in dribbling and how that worked for you?
Yeah, as Coach Williams said, it took quite a bit of practice. I remember quite a few times dribbling the basketball and it's coming right off of my wheel or right off the front of my wheelchair. In wheelchair basketball or any kind of basketball, you like to try to keep your head up while you're dribbling. And I think that was the hardest part, is kind of just getting good with, like, you know, your orientation of your wheelchair and where your arms are pushing and dribbling and all that stuff. But as you practice, it becomes a little bit more of like a second nature, because you get so used to where everything is positioned.
Jake, you mentioned just your history, your resume, if you will, and just high levels of play. And, you know, as head coach in your first year, you do still have fresh eyes, even though you're alum of UW-Whitewater. What do you think of the program at UW-Whitewater for wheelchair basketball? What are its strengths and challenges?
You know, the program at UW-Whitewater has historically been kind of like a basketball factory, and producing a lot of good players that go play overseas and that go play on Team USA. So I think the culture that's been set up over the 50 years at UW-Whitewater is one of the best in the nation. And so I think that I've walked into a situation that has been really, really great. Just like, you know, on the USA tryout list, we have 7 guys that are alumni or currently playing on the team coming up in April. So I think the culture is still there, and I think it's a very great situation, full of guys that want to work hard and that want to win.
Basketball factory. I'll always remember that reference to UW-Whitewater. And I wonder, is it because it's the program has been around for 50 years, a half century? Does that help it just become way more established than other programs? Is that the norm?
That's part of it. And I think a byproduct of that is a lot of alumni have come through and still support the program in a very big way. We still have a lot of alumni that work on campus and that live in the Whitewater area that help out with the program. And so I think what makes it special is that all the alumni want to see the Whitewater team succeed. You know, our game on Thursday is going to be full of alumni. And so I think that's what really helps with the culture. And I think that's what keeps the programs still buzzing.
Jeremy, what does it mean for you and your teammates to have this new head coach who's competed at the highest level of competition in the sport?
It's pretty awesome. It allows us to see kind of a new and more modern perspective of the wheelchair basketball game. I'm sure it's, you know, kind of a cheat code, I would say, being able to have somebody who is as successful overseas and internationally to be able to come back and kind of, you know, give us his tips and tricks on how to be better at basketball. And kind of like you said, it allows us to keep that competitive nature and culture that Whitewater has, you know, been known for alive. So I think that's a pretty awesome part of it.
I want to pick apart a more modern perspective. What does the new era of wheelchair basketball look like to you?
I think from what I've kind of seen and been able to play, like, it's a lot more fast paced than I believe it probably used to be. I would say in the past, like, 50 years, like, the equipment's changed, the level of physicality and all of that stuff. So with new equipment and newer wheelchairs, it allows you to turn quicker, push faster, and able to probably do a lot crazier moves in your wheelchair than you had been able to 50 years ago or so.
Jake, have you seen the evolution of this game in your time with it?
Yeah, a little bit. I kind of started late. So I started in 2008, 2009, but even since then, I've definitely noticed that the technology in the wheelchairs has gotten a lot better. And also at the highest levels of wheelchair basketball, it's changed from about 10 years ago, because you have to have players on the floor that can do everything, that can pass, that can dribble, that can shoot. You can't just have specialists on the floor that can only do one or two things anymore. So if you want to be successful, you really have to have 5 guys that really are well-rounded and can move their chair, can pass, can shoot at a high level. Because I think the game, like Romy said, it's a lot more fast-paced, and it's a lot more of you have to make quick decisions. And so that's what I've noticed in the past 10 years.
Jake Williams, head coach of the men's wheelchair basketball team at UW-Whitewater. Jeremy Meyer is a player on the UW-Whitewater team, transferred in from University of Nebraska-Omaha. Join in with your questions and insights on the fast-paced sport of wheelchair basketball, your connections as a player or spectator. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National Wheelchair Basketball Association hosts the Men's Collegiate Championships at UW-Whitewater, with tournament bracket play set to get underway tomorrow morning. Women's Collegiate Wheelchair Basketball Championship was won Saturday by its host team, the University of Alabama. Join in on all aspects of wheelchair basketball, what you wondered about the sport. 800-642-1234. UW-Whitewater men's wheelchair basketball program head coach Jake Williams is here, and player Jeremy Meyer stays with us as well. Jake, we heard from Kenneth in Beloit called in, and Kenneth wonders if you have to have a disability in order to play wheelchair basketball. Can you explain?
Yeah, so that's a good... So that's a good question. So as of right now in the college division, you don't have to have a disability to be able to play in the intercollegiate division. And everywhere in the world, you don't have to have a disability to be able to play as well. Here in America, in the NWBA, you kind of have to have a disability because they don't allow ABs to play yet, but there are some tournaments like
ABs meaning able-bodied players.
Yep. Okay. Yep. With no disability. Yep. Mm-hmm. I know there are some tournaments like my old boss Keith Wallace in Illinois. He runs a tournament and a league where ABs are allowed to play on the court. I would say you don't necessarily have to. A lot of my friends have played before without a disability, so I think we're definitely moving in that direction.
Jeremy, what are your thoughts on this debate, a long-running debate over whether able-bodied players should be allowed to play the sport in a kind of reverse integration? Where do you stand on that issue?
I'm a pretty big supporter of that idea, where we allow able-bodied individuals to come and try our sport, and, you know, I think it allows able-bodied individuals to really see us for the, you know, competitors that we are. They don't see us as kind of like a charity case, or like, you know, the whole like sympathy aspect where they feel sorry for us, or they think we're these huge inspirations. I think allowing them to play our sport bridges that gap of empathy, to where they no longer see us as inspirations and like these charity cases, but they see us as actual competitors who take a sport seriously and are training at a high performance level like any other able-bodied athlete does.
Let's bring on a call now. Lisa in Milwaukee. Lisa, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I love that you guys are talking about this. This is amazing. I didn't know my nephew had an accident about 2.5 years ago. He's 30 years old now, love playing basketball, but I want to show him you guys' program. Maybe is it too early for him to start practicing to get involved in this?
So what does training look like? Jake, can you field that?
Yeah, so... I think it's never too early to start. I mean, I think I started playing about 2 months after my accident. So The main thing, if he's never played before, I would say just try it and just enjoy the game. You can always train later, but just enjoy the game to start out. And that's my advice to him.
Jake, I think it's remarkable, and I hope we can shed a little more light here on your story. When you were hit on your bicycle and recovering in the hospital as a 16-year-old, you were visited by a member of the UW-Whitewater wheelchair basketball team. Can you tell us a bit more about that story, how it changed you in that moment?
Yeah, that was kind of a coincidence. So when I was in the hospital after my accident, one of the members that was on the Whitewater team, Chris O'Conn, we just happened to have the same doctor, and he was there for an appointment, and his father also worked with mine. And so obviously when everyone at my dad's work heard about my accident, he was like, "Hey, well, my kid plays wheelchair basketball and he got hurt too, so maybe I can go send him to talk to him." And so he came up one day and he started talking about basketball and all the benefits, and he gave my number to a local junior coach, and I started playing, I think, that October. So it's kind of been off from there.
Jeremy, what comes up for you about how you started play after being hit by a car while bicycling?
So I was introduced to wheelchair basketball through my rec therapist at a rehabilitation hospital in Nebraska. But similar to Jake's story, once I kind of found out about wheelchair basketball, I kind of did some research and found a team that was close to me, and I reached out to the coaching staff. And then that next fall, I was hopping in a wheelchair basketball chair and participating in their practices and all that stuff.
So, Jeremy, this is your last season on the team. You hope to represent the U.S. at the 2024 Paris Paralympics. What are your goals?
I will be finished with the team this year, but I am attending graduate school at UW-Whitewater right now. I have another year left of graduate school, and then I plan to try to stick around the Whitewater area because it's such a huge hub for adaptive athletics, to where I would still be able to train and partake in scrimmages and games throughout like the week and all that kind of stuff to keep me in shape. But yeah, ultimately the goal is to make a national team for the Paralympics. But
we'll be rooting for you. All the best on tournament play to both of you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jake Williams, head coach of the men's wheelchair basketball team at UW-Whitewater, his alma mater. Jeremy Meyer, member of the UW-Whitewater wheelchair basketball team. We have a link to tournament site play at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.